We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings.
Wednesday, December 2nd, 1964. That was Mario Savio, student and leader of the free speech movement at the University of California at Berkeley. His words preceded a sit-in and strike led by students against the administration of the university, the climax of nearly 3 months of negotiations, protests, and demonstrations. In mid-September, the Dean of Students informed student political organizations that they would no longer be allowed to use the campus to solicit funds or to advocate off-campus political activity. The ban covered organizations ranging from civil rights groups to Students for Goldwater, Young Democrats, Young Republicans, and the Young Socialist Alliance. Most of these groups, about 20 in all, coalesced into a coordinating organization, the Free Speech Movement, or FSM. For 2 weeks, the students negotiated with university officials in an attempt to have the regulation rescinded. Then, on September 30th, some students set out to violate the regulation. Their actions culminated in the demonstrations of October 1st and 2nd, during which students surrounded a police car for more than 30 hours and refused to allow police to remove from the campus and book a former student who had joined in violating regulations. At the end of the demonstrations, student representatives and University President Clark Kerr reached agreement that
the student demonstrators shall desist from all forms of their illegal protest against university regulations. Number two, a committee representing students, including leaders of the demonstration, faculty and administration will immediately be set up to conduct discussions and hearing into all aspects of political behavior on campus and its control, and to make recommendations to the administration. Three, the arrested man will be booked but released on his own recognizance, and the university, which is the complainant, will not press charges. This is four, the duration of the suspension of the suspended students will be submitted within 1 week to the Student Conduct Committee of the Academic Senate, not to the administration. Five, activity may be continued by student organizations in accordance with existing university regulations.
The agreement solved nothing. The day after it was signed, the university announced that there was no such committee as the Committee on Student Conduct of the Academic Senate, and that the cases of the suspended students would be submitted to a committee appointed by the chancellor, the chief administrative officer on the Berkeley campus. Negotiations began again, and demonstrations resumed. On November 20th, the Board of Regents adopted a policy statement under which all of the previously banned activities would be allowed, but the administration would be empowered to take disciplinary action against students who advocated unlawful off-campus activity. The students responded that allowing disciplinary action for advocacy of unlawful activity placed them in double jeopardy and that the effect of the policy statement was to rule in advance that certain kinds of advocacy were illegal, thus violating the First and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. Demonstrations continued. On November 27th, Chancellor Edward Strong sent four students letters which became the catalysts of the demonstrations which ended December 3rd. The Chancellor informed the four students that they would be required to attend hearings before the Committee on Student Conduct on charges of illegal activity during the demonstrations of October 1st and 2nd. On December 1st, the free speech movement announced that a round-the-clock sit-in would be held in Sproul Hall, the administration building of the Berkeley campus, if the university did not meet three demands by noon December 2nd. The demands were that charges against the four students be dropped, that the university guarantee to take no further action against students, and that university regulations be revised so that only the courts would regulate the content of political expression, that the faculty, students, and administration would jointly regulate the form of political expression, and that university regulations which unnecessarily restrict political activity would be repealed. The demands were not met. At noon on Wednesday, December 2nd, 4,000 to 5,000 persons attended a rally on the steps of Sproul Hall. The main speaker was Mario Savio.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Following Savio's speech, Joan Baez spoke, sang, and led a crowd of 1,100 into the building to begin the sit-in.
The only thing that occurs to me, seeing all of you people there, I don't know how many of you intend to come inside with us, but that is that you muster up as much love as you possibly can, and as little hatred, and as little violence, and as little angries as you can, although I know it's been exasperating. The more love you can feel, the more chance there is for it to be a success.
Students discussed what might happen to them.
I'm going to give instructions for all the contingencies. Nobody should be standing if the police come to eject us. When the police touch you, we request you to do two things: to ask if you're under arrest and to go limp. And it's very easy to go limp. You just sort of
You know,
it's very easy to go limp. It's the easiest thing to do at that time. Now, if you are under arrest, it's going to be very easy. They're going to pick you up and carry you in a paddy wagon. No more instructions are necessary. In terms of what goes on down there, going down there, you give me your name and your address, and that's all. But more likely, they'll eject you. When you're carried out of the building and you're sat down, we're asking you not to get up then and trot off home. We're asking you to sit where you're left, or if anything, sit nearer to the door. So I repeat, we don't want any linking arms. We don't want any fighting with the cops. We don't want anybody hurt or any violent incidents.
At 7 p.m., the doors were closed, and police announced that anyone who remained in the building did so in violation of the law. But the police made no attempt to remove the students. The students showed films. A Hanukkah service was held, ending with a Hatikva. There were classes ranging from a lecture on James Joyce to instruction on civil disobedience.
All right, in other words, what you're saying, you remembered that it is possible that there could be unintentional harm. That's right.
Right.
Okay.
About midnight, most students prepared to go to sleep. At about the same time, Governor Edmund Brown announced, "I have tonight called upon the law enforcement officials in Alameda County to arrest and take into custody all students and others who may be in violation of the law at Sproul Hall. I have directed the California Highway Patrol to lend all necessary assistance. These orders are to be carried out peacefully as a demonstration that the rule of law must be honored in California." The university had not yet issued any statement on the sit-in, but about 1 a.m., the students were awakened with the news that Chancellor Strong was coming with an official statement. He arrived about 3 a.m.
"May I have your attention, please? I am Dr. Edward Strong, Chancellor of the Berkeley campus. I have an announcement. This assemblage has developed to such a point that the purpose and work of the university have been materially impaired. It is clear that there have been acts of disobedience and illegality which cannot be tolerated in a responsible educational center and would not be tolerated anywhere in our society.
Except Berkeley!
The university has shown great restraint and patience in exercising its legitimate authority in order to allow every opportunity for expressing differing points of view. The university always stands ready to engage in the established and accepted procedures for resolving differences of opinion. I request that each of you cease your participation in this unlawful assembly. I urge you, both individually and collectively, to leave this area. I request that you immediately disperse. Failure to disperse will result in disciplinary action by the university. Please go."
"Your attention, please. This is Lieutenant M.F. Chandler of the University of California Police Department. A condition of unlawful assemblage now exists under authority of Section 726 of the Penal Code of the State of California. And in the name of the people of the state of California, I command you to disperse. I further notify you that all persons who do not immediately disperse are in violation of the California state law and are subject to arrest. You have 5 minutes to leave the building or you will be arrested."
Although the group inside had dwindled by then to about 800, few, if any, students left the building under the 5 minute time limit. In the next half hour, police reinforcements arrived, and about 3:45, the arrests began.
"The elevator is stopped here up on the fourth floor. They're using a Polaroid camera, and the police are taking pictures of each of them. Seems that they're not taking chances about misidentification. Looking down the corridor now, I see another demonstrator being picked up off the floor. He also has gone limp. The policemen are trying to lift him up. He slips out from under their arms. They're twisting. One arm is back in a hammerlock. The other arm is bent underneath him. And a third policeman has lifted his legs up, and he's been carried face down into the elevator and has been placed on the ground. He's lying on his stomach. I think they're turning him over now. It's hard to see over the crush of people. They're using numbers printed on slips of paper. And the number they're holding up against his chest as they take his photograph is number 7. Another demonstrator is being moved along. This one hasn't gone completely limp, but he's got his coat twisted around him. I guess by his own desire. He seems now in the elevator to have gone limp. Again, there's this struggle to get him set for a picture. He seems to have gone very limp, and he's a fairly tall fellow, so that they're having a hard time. They seem to have got him set now, and there goes the flashbulb. That, according to the count, if that number was accurate, was number 8. Here comes another demonstrator. This one's a young lady. She's gone limp, more or less, but is walking along with them. No, they've carried her. She was lifted off the ground and carried into the elevator. There is a policewoman, Berkeley policewoman, who's also entered the elevator with her. I see they have the policewoman along in case any of the young lady demonstrators run into any trouble. They're holding a number 9 up. Picture has been taken again. And a short description or statement. Perhaps they're taking some kind of statement or requesting information is being taken. The elevator is now about to descend. The policewoman has left it.
By 7:15, the fourth floor was cleared, but only about 70 students had been arrested. At this point, the pace was accelerated. The highway patrolmen and deputy sheriffs were pressed into service, and the students who had until then been transported to the basement in the elevator were now taken forcibly down the stairs. At about the same time, the police attempted to arrest the leaders of the demonstration. One group of about a dozen policemen made a surprise rush up the main stairs to the second floor, arrested one leader, and took away the microphone of the public address system with which the students had been addressing people outside the building. But there were other leaders and an extra microphone. After that, the students packed in tightly around the window leading to a balcony where the remaining leaders stood to use the PA system. About 8 a.m., police made another rush, this time in greater force.
An entire contingent of Sheriff's Department people from Alameda County and California Highway Patrol have moved into the lobby area of the second floor. Some 30 patrolmen, and the students continue to sit in on the floor. California patrolmen are moving in, led by an inspector in plain clothes, over the students, over the heads of the students who are seated down. They're moving very swiftly, pushing their way up over the seated demonstrators, stepping on them and kicking them. These are men of the California Highway Patrol and Alameda County.
Taken out their nightsticks. They're pushing on up. They're stepping over people. Hey, hold it. Those.
Pushing their way up.
Watch it. Those kids, there are just kids sitting there. My God.
One of the California Highway Patrol.
Hey, easy, does it? Wow. They can make their way through. Jesus.
They've grabbed one kid and pushed him down the steps, beating him on the back of the head. It's a kind of gauntlet. They're kicking them and throwing them down the stairs. They're throwing them down the stairs and pushing them down the stairs out of the way. I don't know what's happening to these kids, but it looks horrible. They're tugging them by their feet and throwing them down the stairs, literally tossing them down the steps between them. There's a double line of cops directly in front of me. And they're tossing them down the stairs. One of the police officials has just come over and shaken his head, said, go on, go on. They've cleared a spot. The cops in front of me are laughing. They've thrown boys and girls down the stairs, their heads jostling and banging against the banisters and marble stairs. One fellow was just going down slowly and was grabbed and pushed by one particular policeman here, directly in front of me. There's a cop here who's speaking to one of the kids sitting in the corner, directly to my left, who's refused to move. One kid is now being pulled feet first down the stairs. Some other cops are grabbing him. Well, we'll report this as the press. All right, okay, okay, all right, okay. Well, we're moving. Fine, okay. All right, fine.
They can walk.
The police have ordered us to get out of the way until they've gotten this cleaned up.
Down.
We've just about been tossed down the stairs. They're pulling the kids down by their legs, bouncing them down the stairs. None of the kids that I've seen have fought back in any way whatsoever. The cops are turning around and going back. One of them has just kicked a shoe that was lying on the stair into the bunch of kids sitting down on the floor.
Later, reporters spoke to some of the students who had been thrown down the stairs.
I'm a student here, yes. I'm a junior. Nothing happened to me. The cop just grabbed me and pulled me down the stairs, and somebody else pulled me, grabbed my arm, and then I went limp, and then another grabbed my leg, and they jerked me, and then they, you know, shoved me down the stairs, and another said, can you walk? And I didn't answer. He said, well, all right then. And he grabbed me and shoved me down further. Then a couple others grabbed me by the legs and shoved me down. But I did see, well, one cop hit a girl with his fist as hard as he could on the forehead.
Was there any provocation for that?
No, she was just sitting there.
Did you give any provocation?
No.
Yes, I'm a student here. I was sitting right by the banister at the top of the stairs, and as the policemen were going along the other side of the stairs, they were storming in there, and there was a lot of things happening behind me that I didn't even know. One sheriff's deputy was standing right in front of me, and he asked me, he started to step through, and I was sitting there, and he said, will you move? And I said, I'm sitting here. And he did strike me in the face with his open hand. It, left no injury.
I'm a sophomore in the College of Letters and Science. A policeman had stepped on my thigh. I demanded that he look down and see what he was doing. He did and responded by jumping up and down on it. I could not find any numbers on any of the policemen. They apparently were not wearing them or were hiding them inside their coats.
Larry, did you offer any provocation?
No, I did not.
Ray, did you see any badge numbers or badges or numbers on helmets?
None at all, and I went up to look at one of the helmets. There is no number on it.
From then on, newsmen were generally excluded from the third floor, where arrests continued, and the back stairs down which the arrested students were dragged. The police taped newspapers over the glass windows on doors to the stairwells.
At the moment, one of the university policemen is putting up some newspaper to cover over the panes in the windows. There's another student being dragged down by two highway patrolmen with white helmets. I can't see any reason why those windows should be closed, except the students are being bounced down the stairs.
Yeah, well, the point here is that I, as you probably have already heard, we were blocked from any view of something that we were watching for a long time. I was standing very close to the window watching the kids, most of whom, at least half of whom, were being bounced down the stairs, some of them in extreme fashion. You can hear it right now, they're literally dragging him down. You can hear the bumping. And at this point, one of the policemen suddenly said, you, pointing to me, you stand away, get 15 feet away. And then I started to walk away, and he says, now go on away, get out of the line here. So I was out of the line of vision. And then one of the ABC newsman, the American Broadcasting Company man, came over and said, look, we are supposed to be allowed to be at the point of production where the arrest is taking place. He said, that's what we do in San Francisco. And some large lieutenant said, well, that's not the way we do it over here, buddy.
You helped cover up the windows, didn't you? Is there any reason for covering up the windows?
Well,
thought I saw you.
Well, you might have thought you
said. Okay, Sergeant, thank you. Sergeant in the University Police Force, who said, I thought I saw him covering up the windows. There goes someone right now. He's being dragged down by both arms stretched out. We can only see them at one turn in the stairway. It seems that the police haven't been able to find enough newspaper to cover up the top of the windows, and we can see just the top of a turn on the stairway. So you see about 6 feet of people being pulled down by their arms or collars with their spines bouncing on the stairs as they go.
Later, University President Clark Kerr issued a statement in which he said in part,
University, which has always stood for democratic principles, including observance of the law, expects faculty, staff, and students to carry on the orderly processes of the university and to reject what has become an FSM attempt at anarchy. The FSM issued an ultimatum which had nothing to do with free speech and which it knew and publicly stated the university could not possibly accept. This ultimatum called for the abdication by the university of its responsibilities. The ultimatum was not accepted. The FSM then again seized Sproul Hall, as it had done before, and stated it planned to bring the university to a grinding halt. The FSM and its leaders from the start declared the police would have to haul them out. They are now finding that, in their effort to escape the discipline of the university, they have thrown themselves into the arms of the community at large. They have asked that they be subject only to external law and external courts. They are learning that the community is no more sympathetic with anarchy than the university they so violently condemn.
It was after 6 p.m., more than 14 hours after arrest began, before the 635 policemen finished clearing Sproul Hall. The district attorney announced that 780 persons had been arrested, and according to university records, about 80% were students, faculty, or other employees. They were booked on as many as three charges: illegal assembly, failure to disperse, and resisting arrest, a charge which includes going limp when arrested. Bail for those booked on all three charges was set at $110.
Some people do not understand why the faculty is sympathetic to any extent with the students in this present crisis, and why it is critical to some extent of the administration.
This is Professor Henry May at a press conference held by faculty members of the University of California, Friday, December 4th.
When this whole business started back in September, the starting point for the students was that certain political privileges, collecting money and collecting signatures, were suddenly withdrawn. In the opinion of the students and of a good many of the faculty, the reasons given were not sufficient and were somewhat contradictory. This is what gave rise to the tragic and unfortunate incident involving the police car on October 2nd. After that, as you know, a settlement was negotiated. And the fact that a settlement was negotiated seems to me to indicate some admission that there was fault on more than one side. And since then, problems were intensely discussed by a tripartite faculty student administration committee. These negotiations were not successful and broke down. However, the faculty contingent in that committee made certain complex recommendations for new rules regarding student political action. The recommendations of the faculty groups were praised by spokesmen of the administration. They were, to some extent and in part, accepted by the Board of Regents. In a meeting of the Academic Senate, a majority of the faculty in that meeting upheld the administration, defeated a move to take regulatory powers of this sort from the administration and give it to the faculty. Then last Monday, the administration announced a decision to to press for actions, press for penalties for actions taken 2 months before during the initial crisis. And the students at this point, rightly or wrongly, but I think very understandably, felt that they had been tricked. And it's at this point that far bigger demonstrations broke out than had ever taken place before, that very unpleasant and rough statements were made about entering Sproul Hall and so forth. No measures were taken to prevent the students from entering Sproul Hall. And as a result, they occupied it. And as a result, as you know, the governor called the police.
The announcement of disciplinary action against four students had precipitated larger demonstrations than ever before. The arrests in Sproul Hall made demonstrators and debaters for or against the free speech movement of almost everyone connected with the university. The immediate reaction of the FSM's supporters was to call a student strike and to hold another rally. Both students and faculty members spoke at the rally, and they gained support from three state legislators.
I got a call this morning, and someone asked me if I would like to appear before you and speak.
Assemblyman William Stanton of San Jose.
I was afraid that I might get run over in the crush of public officials coming forward to defend free speech. There have been many things that I haven't liked during my connection with the university. I was here during the famous Loyalty Oath controversy of the 50s. The regents, in their infinite wisdom, decided it was time to purify the institution and to drive out the communists. Well, if you go through the court reports, you'll find that the Supreme Court of California held that this was an unconstitutional exercise of power on the part of the regents. It was lawbreaking. It was illegal. But never were the regents put in jail for breaking the law, for destroying a great faculty, and humiliating a great institution. But I'm not here to raise hell with the regents or the administration. As a matter of fact, Ed Strong, the present chancellor, was a professor of mine. And many of the great liberal beliefs that I hold and espouse, and that's why I'm here today, because I hold liberal beliefs, I believe in a free institution. Many of those great liberal beliefs were given to me by Ed Strong. And he came through with liberalism. I was surprised that the power elite, the power structure, would ever put a man in a position who taught the liberalism that he taught. I want to know what happens when a system takes a man who's inherently good and liberal and puts him in a position where ultimately the police are called and we have the kind of circumstances that have occurred here in this university.
Assemblyman Willie Brown of San Francisco.
Now, the responsible people in this state, or the allegedly responsible people in this state, are taking the position that yours is not a worthy cause. They're taking the position that there is nothing wrong with the University of California, that some hell-mented highway patrolman and Alameda County Sheriff's Department fellows can't handle. Well, I think that the people in the state of California need to know that there is something seriously wrong with this university when 801 people are dragged bodily downstairs from the administration building of this university and arrested. There's something wrong when faculty members of this university call for the ouster of Chancellor Strong. There's something wrong when some of us ask for the resignation of Clark Kerr. Obviously, there's something wrong with this university that the world needs to know about.
Assemblyman John Burton of San Francisco.
I will be very brief. You know, when Willie was talking about the fact that the responsible leadership in the state of California were against the free speech movement and that all the newspapers were against the free speech movement, I thought he was talking about Willie Brown and John Burton's candidacy for the assembly because they were all against us, and we won, and you're going to win.
Opponents of the FSM also spoke out. Charles Powell, president of the student government, held a press conference at which he said,
"Well, I think that the FSM has finally succeeded in perhaps what they wanted to do, and that's a dividing of the entire campus community over the so-called free speech movement, which is a catchy name for their desire to gain the right of illegal off-campus advocacy on campus. Anyone who has any knowledge of our state government structure realizes that the only way to gain political activity is through legal means. These legal means are: support can be gained in the legislature to change the state constitution, which would then allow the regents to permit such advocacy of illegal acts to take place on campus. The other method would be to force a test case into the courts. Both of these means are legal and orderly, and the only accepted means of political change that will be accepted by the powers who control this university and the state government."
The student government sponsored a rally of its own, and one of the speakers was Professor Milton Chernin, Dean of the School of Social Welfare.
"One of the points that I would like to emphasize is that a great deal of progress has been made in this area of social action and the regulations thereof since the semester started. The second point that I want to make is that everyone knows that not all of the issues have been resolved. And people differ strongly on the one rule that the university at the present time insists on, and that is that it is going to take disciplinary action for social and political actions planned on campus which are illegal off campus. The issue of civil disobedience, of when, if ever, is it right to do illegal things to accomplish ends which to which you are passionately and morally and ethically devoted, is an issue which is a part of the great dialogue of America right now."
On Sunday, December 6th, the Council of Department Chairmen announced that it had drawn up a proposal which had been approved by President Kerr. On Monday, December 7th, all classes were canceled from 9 a.m. to noon, and a university meeting was held at which the department chairman's proposal was made public. The chairman criticized the FSM, urged ending the strike, and said that the regulations the FSM had criticized should be accepted pending the report of the Academic Senate's Academic Freedom Committee. They also proposed that the university take no disciplinary action against students involved in the political controversy prior to December 3rd, the day the sit-in had ended. But both the free speech movement and a significant portion of the faculty were not satisfied. A group of about 200 faculty members had already drawn up a different sort of proposal for submission to the Academic Senate on Tuesday, December 8th. As presented to the Senate meeting by Professor Joseph Garbarino, chairman of the Academic Freedom Committee, the motion read,
1, that there shall be no university disciplinary measures against members or organizations of the university community for activities prior to December 8th connected with the current controversy over political speech and activity. That the time, place, and manner of conducting political activity on the campus shall be subject to reasonable regulation to prevent interference with the normal functions of the university. That the regulations now in effect for this purpose shall remain in effect provisionally, pending a future report of the Committee on Academic Freedom concerning the minimal regulations necessary. Section 3, that the content of speech or advocacy should not be restricted by the university. Off-campus student political activities shall not be subject to university regulation. On-campus advocacy or organization of such activities shall be subject only to such limitations as may be imposed under Section 2. 4, that future disciplinary measures in the area of political activity shall be determined by a committee appointed by and responsible to the Berkeley Division of the Academic Senate.
Debate on the motion began with seconding speeches.
I will comment only upon point three. We should regard it and support it as symbolizing the fundamental commitment of the university to its own essential nature, for it expresses the conviction that ours is an institution whose proper mode of dealing with the mind is educational, not coercive. We are not the secular arm. If we have forgotten this, we should be grateful to those who are now reminding us.
We believe that the adoption of this resolution by the Academic Senate is crucial, not only to the solution of the present crisis, but to the survival of the university as a significant institution in American intellectual life. We do not believe the present resolution is perfect. We believe, however, that the resolution comes close to being optimal under the circumstances. I believe that many share my feeling that this resolution is our best, perhaps now our only hope of settling what has been one of the most agonizing, shattering, and potentially destructive experiences that any American university has ever had to pass through.
Then an amendment was offered and debate resumed.
First line of paragraph three, to alter it as follows, that the content of speech or advocacy on this campus, provided that it is directed to no immediate act of force or violence, should not be restricted by the university. The particular resolution which we will enact will probably become a model for many of the universities from here to the East Coast and including the state of Mississippi. As this resolution stands now without an amendment, it would allow a student Ku Klux Klan chapter to organize itself on campuses to carry on meetings at which they would advocate, plan, and organize actions for defacing Jewish synagogues, Negro and Catholic churches, and they would claim the protection of the university sanctuary for these acts of speech, advocacy, and organization. Unless we have a provision, some amendment, which will make it clear that we do not condone this sort of action or behavior, we are opening the way for every extremist and crackpot organization which can then enter upon this campus, advocate its most immediate measures without fear of any action on the part of the university, and then the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other police agencies will be able to claim with some show of force that since the university is not carrying out the most minimal safeguards of democracy, that they have the right to infiltrate our premises with their agents. We will then truly become a police university.
It has been suggested that any restriction on speech or advocacy or organization that is allowed on this campus by the administration will inevitably mean the policing and perhaps the prior censorship of all such speech and advocacy, and perhaps the prior restriction of all such organization. I would like to point out that, in my understanding, these are principles that govern the situation. The university still retains the right to act under circumstances that are outrageous and detrimental to free speech and democracy. I think it is not too difficult to envisage a situation where, without trying to raise anybody's hair, force and violence is directly organized on the campus, and the campus has, and the administration or the student committee governing this has no recourse at all in such a situation, either in terms of forbidding such activity or in terms of disciplining anyone involved in it.
Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto the university that which belongs to the university. As to the substance of what men say, this place should be absolutely free. So far as the university is concerned, this is an educational institution. We are engaged in the business of education. That function carries us into lots of areas of thought and even some areas of activity. We're concerned with with knowing ourselves, with discovering knowledge, with spreading knowledge, with developing among our students some sense of morality and some capacity for self-government in a democracy. All of this requires that we adhere to standards which will permit people to say what is on their minds. We should not forbid them to say anything. All right, now our concern is not violence. This is the concern of the civil community. This is the concern of the FBI. And if Professor Foyer thinks that the FBI does not now have a right to come on this campus, he better think again. We should leave all these matters of restriction of content to the civil society, where constitutional restraints will be imposed on those who act to invade freedom of speech. We should be concerned with the intellectual and spiritual task of running a university where anybody can say whatever is on his mind, and other people can listen to him and think about it and make up their minds whether they agree or not. This resolution is not just a declaration of principle, this proposal that Dr. Foyer is making. It opens up to university regulation what we are here saying should not be regulated by the university in any manner, shape, or form.
I think Professor Tenbruck is wrong when he says that the resolution of the Academic Freedom Committee gives Caesar that which is Caesar's. The position that we can permit the organization of any lawless action on the campus, that is, the campus organization of any lawless action in the community, is, in my opinion, tenable only if at the same time we recognize the moral right. I'm not talking about legal rights, but the moral right of the police to come to our campus and suppress this activity. This moral right I'm not willing to concede to the general law enforcement agencies. I cannot prevent them from coming to our campus in certain contingencies, but I want to minimize these contingencies. And consequently, I must draw the conclusion that we ourselves must have a possibility in outrageous cases of lawlessness, which are advocated or organized on the campus, to interfere with our own academic means. Nobody wants to regulate the content of speeches or other expressions when it is a matter of nonviolence. Any philosophy can be advocated by students, by faculty, by anybody. We have made great progress in this respect as far as outside speakers are concerned. We are now much freer than we used to be. I would not hesitate to fight the regents, as we probably will have to when this resolution is adopted, to fight the regents on a defensible cause. We have done that before. We shall, in all probability, have to do it again. But I do not want the Academic Senate to put itself into a position in which this fight cannot be conducted from a basis which is inherently not defensible.
No one here is in favor of force and violence. But if we adopt this amendment, this will mean one thing to the people who have been most active in this struggle, people whom I honor and respect despite their shortcomings, and who I think have done a great service to the university, this free speech movement. They will understand this only in one way, namely that this vague language about advocating action directed towards force and violence, or however it is stated, as once again putting them in the position in which if they prepare boycotts or sit-ins or picketing against the outside community in the name of civil liberties and preserving and safeguarding the rights of minorities, that they are again subject to the same kind of punitive threats and actualities as has led to this miserable situation in the first place.
There are strange happenings on our campus in these days. There are meanings to be read from them. I think the students have attempted to be articulate in explaining them to us. I think they have had real difficulty. On the matter of nonviolent civil disobedience, the students are quite proud of their use of the method called civil disobedience. They have used it under some of the most trying conditions, particularly in the South. They are proud of its feature of putting high value on the human lives of others and at the same time low value on the rules of man, which seem at times rather arbitrary, especially to the young people. We probably must convince them that they have at their disposal other tools, tools that are more suitable for all, but fully effective. Mr. Chairman, I feel that many of the actions that our students would be most proud of might run into difficulty with the Foyer Amendment. I regard the occupation of Sproul Hall as a use of force, but not a use of violence.
Professor Chamberlain spoke of nonviolent civil disobedience. I submit that what we have seen and continue to see here on this campus during this crisis period is violent, uncivil disobedience. And if we do not face up to the question of whether we will bow in one form or another to this kind of pressure, we are not meeting our main obligation here this afternoon. The students have obviously found a good thing. They have discovered a means of not only debating, but achieving some consequences resulting from that debate, which in my judgment are enormous. Unless we put our foot down on this major issue here this afternoon and not ask the courts to enforce some minor regulations or to engage in some major constitutional thinking on this question, this is our responsibility. Indeed, this is the final opportunity for the university, and the faculty has the honor of facing up to that opportunity directly, that it has refused to face up to, indeed has capitulated to forces which destroy that responsibility up to this point. We are not merely passing judgment on a minor aspect of a student movement. We are enacting a new system for making decisions and arriving at policies at a major American institution. Indeed, it may affect our democracy as a whole.
We are not in the business here of regulating speech, that is to say, the content of speech. Our problem is to find a policy that is tenable, that can be defended, that can be implemented, that can find its way into a series of regulations and governing provisions that we can all live with and that are proper to a university. The university has all the resources it needs to deal with disorderly behavior on this campus. It can deal with disorderly behavior by invoking its own rules. It can deal with disorderly behavior by invoking the rules of the civil authority. It retains the right to file charges against anyone who breaks the law. Our problem is not the control of acts, but of speech. And we are moving here. I sincerely hope we shall conclude here a movement toward a policy that protects the content of speech and that assumes the risks of that protection. We want to invoke the new policy, the policy we should have had all along, the policy we are adopting not out of concession to pressure, not out of submission to outside forces, but because I think at long last we are ready to adopt a policy that should have been with us through all these times. We adopt this policy not only because it is consistent with the Constitution of the United States, we adopt this policy because it is the most fitting policy for a great university.
The Senate then took two votes. The first was on the amendment, and the Senate defeated it, 737 against and 284 in favor. The second vote was on the motion itself.
I ask that those all in favor of the motion please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
The motion is carried. If there is a call for a division, we will have a count. All right, well, you heard the call.
There was a pause as the tally was taken. Then,
the secretary, please announce the vote.
Mr. Chairman, the vote is 824 aye, 115 nay.
The entire Senate meeting had been broadcast through a public address system outside the building, and hundreds of students stood listening as the vote count was announced.
Chairman, the vote is 824 aye, 115 nay.
The free speech movement and its supporters greeted the Academic Senate's action as a victory, and Mario Savio called it magnificent, a victory for the FSM and for the university. But the long-range effect of the action cannot yet be judged. By its vote, the Senate took a step into uncharted areas and now faces new kinds of problems, not only within the university, but in relations between the university and the rest of society. The University of California is a semi-autonomous organ of the state, subject ultimately to the state legislature. In addition, the Senate's action does not, by itself, change the administrative system. It only asks the Board of Regents to make that change. At the moment of the Senate's action, it appeared to both faculty and students to be the only means to achieve peace at the university. But the total effect of the Senate's action depends on what President Kerr has called the university's many publics, and an answer to the question, will it succeed, lies in the future.